Welcome to Jewish History with Rabbi David Katz, connecting the human side to Jewish history. For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.
Hi, it's Sunday afternoon, and I'm going to take advantage of this opportunity to take a crack at the Haftorah, which is being sponsored by the Elbaums, Ari and Hilda Elbaum, and by Ed and Robin Hoffman, in other words, close friends of mine, in honor, well, in memory of the passing of the mom, of the mother, of Dr. Jerry Insull, who all of us are very close with. I'm closer than all of them as a patient and as a friend and as member of my shul. We are very close, but I won't go into that. And his mother passed away not long ago, I think 2 months or so, Mrs. Rose Insull, originally Rose Gwertzman. And they're doing this in tribute to her memory, which is very nice. And Dr. Insull is famous as the big tzaddik here in Baltimore, for those that know him. Not that you should know him. You should never need to know a doctor. But if you do, right, if you do, you'll discover what I mean. And without any further ado, it's very appropriate for the Hoffmans and the Elbaums to do this. And we thank them for sponsoring. This week is, I'm just taking this shot off my, I'm giving you my guest today. They have the Haftorah this week is Parsha Chodesh, so therefore you have the Haftorah Parsha Chodesh, which is usually very obscure. It's from the book of Yecheskel, Ezekiel, in chapter, 45 and 46. And we have this, and the whole thing has to do with a lot of ceremonials. For the regular person out there, this is maybe the most boring Haftorah, because it's not even talking about the regular Beis HaMikdash. It's talking about the Bayis Shlishi, we think, and it's talking about some mysterious figure called the Nasi. And what the heck is that? I mean, I know about a future king, we think. We have David HaMelech and Mashiach Medavid and all the rest of it. And he goes through all this elaborate description of how he moves around the temple and people stand up and so on. He goes in one door, goes out the other door. And the reason it's the Haftorah Parshas HaChodesh, a little strange to me, is that there's mention of Pesach over here. What Pesach will be one day in the future. B'rishon b'arba siyom l'chodesh yel Pesach chag shavuos yomim Matzah Yochel, and so on and so forth. The big question, the big enchilada, as far as I'm concerned, who is the Nasi? I'm not the only one asked the question. I'm too lazy to go and pull out all the books and see all the different opinions again, because that's all they are different opinions. And the problems of Book Yecheskel are famous. I've mentioned them in the past. Many of you know the Gemara that says that the Bichu Lignos is the Sefer Yecheskel. There were some obscurities. The Book of Ezekiel would seem to contradict the Chumash. And as a result, they wanted to bury the book and not include it in the Bible. Because after all, the Tanakh that you and I have, the Torah Vim Ksum, is an edited document. And in other words, we don't know what the original looked like. Maybe in the case of Chumash we do, that's different. But in the Vim Ksum, we don't know what the original looked like. We know what the Anshei Segdola finally passed through their hands or some equivalent body of authority. Although the fact that they did that and gave all the Jews a standard Torah, a standard text, or a pretty doggone standard, is of extreme importance, as I've mentioned 100 times, because that meant that all the Jews were scattered all over the world, wherever they were, no matter how far apart they were, they all had the same Tanakh. These are part of what they call the portable fatherland that kept Jews in commonalities, like a glue that kept the Jews together. I've given that speech 1,000 times. All right, so it's in centripetal versus in centrifugal. Having said that, so Yecheskel is famous for living at the end of the Bayis Rishon. He was taken off to Babylonia along with the Galus Yochanan, like Mordechai was. And he has visions. Sometimes they're like a virtual reality tours of the Beis HaMikdash, in which he sees them mooning the Beis HaMikdash, doing all kind of Odezer in the secret chambers within the walls. Notice he's given a vision why the temple is going to be destroyed. Shun, I get it. I understand. Now, for whatever reason, and again, I've talked about this in the past at length, not just me, For whatever reason, the Beis HaMikdash that he focuses on, because Yechezkel being a Navi, he says, don't worry, this Beis HaMikdash will be destroyed, but there will be another one. But the one he describes is not identical with the Second Temple. Now, some parts of it are, some parts aren't. I read the Rambam once. The Rambam said the Beis Sheni had some elements of Beis Rishon and some elements of the Beis Shlishi. But, in its architecture and so forth. But it's in Rambam. But what is this third temple he's talking about over here? And for our purposes today, what's the pshat with this Nasi guy? Right? Tell me you have a Mashiach, a king, somebody like that. Now I'm going to give you my guess. This is what I think. I could be wrong. That's what I think. Very interestingly, there seems to be a concept within Judaism. It's unclear that there's some temporary figure between zero and Mashiach. There's zero like we have today, and then there's something, and then there's Mashiach. I'll tell you what I mean. For example, just off the top of my head. Beis Rishon, you had a king from the beginning. So you had a Melch. He had, so to speak, a Mashiach. Shlomo Melch was a Mashiach. He was anointed, right? David HaMelech was a Mashiach. That's what Mashiach means, anointed. Meaning with the special oil and all the rest of it, chosen by God. Doesn't mean they're perfect, but it's chosen by God. Now, let's look at the Second Temple, which had a different history. Second Temple was around a couple hundred years. Almost all the time, listen closely, almost all the time, it was under foreign occupation. It was first part of the Persian Empire. Subsequently, when Cyrus and then later after Purim, Dariush allowed the Jews to return, whoever decided to return. Most of the Jews seem to have stayed away, but enough returned to make something of it. And they built the Second Temple, as you know. Okay? Now, when they built the Second Temple, they had a Kohen Gadol. There was no king. They're part of the Persian Empire. Matter of fact, they had to bend over backwards to show how loyal they were to the Persian Empire, because the way that the Arabs and the other junk persuaded the king of Persia in the first place to Cyrus, I'm talking about, to make a stop order on the go order that he originally issued to let the Jews rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, was by saying, if you let them go and build this place, they'll go into local patriotism, they'll rebel against the Persian Empire, and you'll have a gigantic headache. I mean, they exaggerate. They say you won't control any of the lands beyond the Euphrates. It's all in the book of Ezra, which was ridiculous. But nevertheless, the idea was, if you let the Jews rebuild Yerushalayim and rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, they'll go into business for themselves. This was not true. Okay? All during the time of the Persian Empire, Beis HaMikdash remained under Persia. There was no attempt, as far as we know, to make a Davidic king, okay? There's no king. Now, it's obscure, a Vervase, and we know there was Rubavel Ben Shaltiel, who led, together with Yeshua and Tzedek, the very first people, the beginning of Cyrus's reign, to go back and rebuild the base, just to rebuild Yerushalayim. And Rubavel Ben Shaltiel was from the royal family. So theoretically, he was an appropriate candidate to be king, have things worked out in a certain way, right? And let's say, for example, I'm just making this up. Let's say as a result of the Purim story, the Jews were able to become politically independent in Judea. Through Bevel or somebody like it would have become the king. There's even a prophecy or two I remember from Haggai and elsewhere where he says, I'll put Zerubbabel as like a chosam, as a signet ring of mine, says God, meaning I like Zerubbabel. And that's why he's immortalized in the Moshe Sur. The Jewish people are great. Nobody knows the book of Haggai, but everybody knows Kates Bavel, Zerubbabel. We go by songs. Anyhow, whatever the case is, what was Zerubbabel, for example? He wasn't a king. He was kind of a Nasi. Right? If I was a Bible critic, you'd say Ezekiel is referring to the Zerubbabel phenomenon, and maybe it's written later and all that sort of thing. But if you're not, if you're regular from Jude, so what's going on over here? Listen closely. So the Jews were part of the Persian Empire for a couple hundred years, without getting into all the tangle of the chronology and all the rest of it. And then they were taken over by Alexander the Great and the Greeks and the Hellenists. In other words, They didn't gain their independence. They switched from one foreign overlord to another. If you want to get very, very technical, they switched from being under Persia to being under Alexander the Great to being under Antigonus Cyclops to being under the Ptolemies and then eventually under the Seleucids. At no time are we familiar, do we know, of an attempt by the Jews to set up a war of independence. They were content to be part of an empire, a Geisha empire, a province of somebody else's empire. The only thing is, just give us our religious freedom. We have our own Beis HaMikdash. We run the show the way we run the show. We are willing to pay the taxes to the Geisha overlord, whether to Persia, to Alexander, Ptolemy, Seleucus, whoever, and shine. As you and I know, this seamless system, this happy system, went on for a couple hundred years until it did not. The inherent problem is you're under foreign rulership, and all you need is one foreign king to try to upset the apple cart, and that is where you and I call Hanukkah with the story of Antiochus IV. So Antiochus IV went against the Jewish religion. As we all know, that provoked rebellion, which was successful in the long run, took a long time. And the Jews actually set up a state, okay? Now, when they set up a state, it was a funny business because of the Maccabees, the Hashmonaim. Now, who were the Hashmonaim? If you read the sources closely, particularly in the first book of Maccabees, to some degree in the second book of Maccabees, which are the oldest sources, so you'll find you have people like Judah Maccabee and his brothers and stuff like that. What were they? They were the Kohen Gadols. I mean, that is true, at least according to Maccabees. What else were they? Because they weren't simply officiants in the temple of Jerusalem, spending all day long offering carbonas and stuff like that. They were basically kings. They raised and commanded an army. They organized and administered a state. They did the taxes. You know, the whole nine yards of being a king. They even had a royal court. If you remember, it talks about the fact that by the time you get to Shimon, which is the brother of Judah Maccabee, was the last survivor, he already had like goblets of gold and things like that. You know, the business Hatzach Yolungin. And so, you know, they were doing okay. So let me put it this way. He was a king in all but name. There are terms for this, ethnarch or whatever. He was a king in all but name. But he did not take the title of king. Okay? It's very important. Now, I'm speaking now from a very frum Torah-dick point of view. He didn't take the title of king, so what's the shot? But he was the guy there, and the people recognized that the Maccabee family were the heroes of the struggle, and in their opinion, the Maccabee family was best guided to lead, and so they named them hereditary rulers of the Jewish people, but they weren't kings, right? So they were Nazis. Now, again, I'm speaking from a very firm point of view. The idea is that they should continue to build up the state. And if they remained firm, which they did not, but if they remained firm, that at a certain point, once you had a kingdom, and the Maccabees and Hashmonaim actually reconquered all of Israel, even more, right? If you look at the Maccabean, the Hasmonean kingdom, as they call it, by the time it's over, I mean, it did include the Gaza Strip, by the way, which David never had. So it's very interesting that they physically rebuilt the land, the kingdom, reconstituted the kingdom, but they weren't kings, meaning they're not from David HaMelech. If they were, like I say, real frum and Torah-dick, at some point, they would have said like this, let's find the right guy from Malchus Beis David and hand him the show. You take over, you be the Melech now. That would have been a very frum scenario. Again, if you want to get down to nitty-gritty, you would have had, after Judah Maccabee and Yonasan, you had Shimon, who was assassinated. But let's say he wasn't assassinated. He was a frum guy, as far as we can tell. So he would have built up the kingdom. And then, at the right moment, he would say like this, you know, I'm a Kohen. I can't really be a king. You take over, you be the king. Right? Whoever they would have picked who's come from David HaMelech, the right Yichus. Because that's the problem with monarchy. Or any hereditary office, you got to have the right yichus. It's like the yeshiva world today. You can be very good, but the only guy who's going to get a job is if you have the right yichus or marry into it. As they get this. So, what happened? Well, things got screwed up along the way. Shimon HaMaccabee was assassinated. He was succeeded by his son, John Hyrcanus, Yochanan Kohen Gadol. Yochanan Kohen Gadol found himself with a country riveted by domestic strife, especially of religious issues, what you and I call the Prussian versus the Sedukin. It was a bummer. In other words, neither John Hyrcanus nor his successors, who were less from even than him, were in a mood to give up an ounce of their power. So in other words, it screwed up. Again, speaking from a very Torah-digger point of view, you could say that the reason the Hasmonean kingdom collapsed with the arrival of the Romans was divine punishment for, you know, taking over the kingdom and not handing it over to David. The Ramban, as I think many of you know, in Parshas Vayechi, more or less says that. I mean, he doesn't spell it out in the historical detail so much, and he concentrates on the fact, which is only known from Maccabees and Yosefon, that the five brothers all died a violent death, Judah, Yonasan, Yochanan, Shimon, and Elazar. Elazar is the one who fell into the elephant. She said, the reason they all died of violent death is because they took the kingdom and they weren't melachim. It's not exactly true, because Judah Maccabee and the brothers did not take the kingdom. The Ramban obviously would say that they were de facto kings, and he would even find that objectionable. But hello, Doverhu, that they didn't take the kingship, and that itself was a sign of tremendous respect for the tradition. Now, the grandson did, okay? Notice he had the five brothers, Judah Maccabee and the last one being Shimon, and then he had Shimon's son, who again was frum enough, despite his other problems, he was frum enough to not take the title of kingship. Maybe, at the end of his life, when he was influenced by the Sadducan, maybe took the right title of king. It's not clear. And Josephus, in those places, which go into details, they don't say that. There is that famous scene in the Gemara where it says, Rav loch keser malchus, hanach keser gukun lezar shalaron. Right? So, be satisfied with the keser malchus. I don't know how literally that's supposed to be taken. It's supposed to be taken that he was mamash a melech, claimed the title of melech or not. But Pashup Shah, he was a Nasi. In other words, his title was Kohen Gadol. De facto, he commanded the army because he built up the army. De facto, he ran the civil administration. The Chachamim, for most of the reign of John Hyrcanus, had a share in the power. Notice he consulted them, which is the right thing to do. Today you say like this, I'm asking Das Torah. Totally fine. Doesn't mean you listen to him all the time, but you listen to him for most of his reign for a substantial amount of time. And then he died. His son was completely not from Aristobulus. Again, I'm going by what Josephus says, which is the only source. Maybe Yosefon, I remember. And that son was a full, in fact, he was called Philhellene, Greek lover. And he was completely not from. So he, Taka, took the title of king. You understand? So something which Judah Maccabee did not have the chutzpah to do, or any of his brothers, or even Yochanan Kohen Gadol, even John Hyrcanus, who were de facto were kings, never took the title. Okay? So what were they? Again, formally speaking, they were Kohen Gadol. We all know what that is. What title did you have for the other thing that I just described, which is commander of the army, head of the administration, charge of foreign policy, and so forth and so on? And the answer is Nasi. Right? What else? I mean, that's all I can think of. It's a Nasi. So, it's like intermediate. And I'll say it again. Suppose things had worked out different than I just described. And suppose, in point of actual fact, they would have done the frum way. You say, oh, very good. There was no melucha. Then there was an intermediate period, which you and I call the Maccabees and the Chashmonaim. And then it was followed by a Malchus Beis David. And you'd say like this, well, the Chashmonaim, the Maccabees are pretty good guys. You know what I mean? They stepped up to the plate. They led the people in the war to preserve Judaism. It's clear that heaven was in favor of them because that's the whole point of the miracle of Hanukkah. Then at a certain point, they should have stepped aside. For your information, the Ramban says exactly those words in regards to other kings that were anointed in the Book of Malachim from the Malchus of the North. That they're there for a while, but then at a certain point, they should have stood aside and handed over to Malchus Beis Dovid. Now, it's against the human nature to work and build up a business and put in sweat equity and all the rest of it, and then say, I'm giving it, you know, to someone else. But that's what they were supposed to do. And had they done that, there would have been a big mitzvah. Since they did not, again, I'm giving you a very firm point of view. Since they failed to do that, and nobody protested, as far as we know, so they suffered the catastrophe of the Romans, which led, of course, to the Korban of everything. Right? It wasn't done right. So, with that history lesson in mind, we look at our Haftorah and all the rest of it, and we see what's the third temple going to be about, because today's Haftorah, this week, is all about the Bais Shlishi, the third temple, which has not come into existence yet. And we see reference to a figure called a Nasi, and what that suggests is that there'll be an intermediate period of the Geula. In other words, one way to understand the future messianic era is to say that we're all in Gaulus, we're all suffering, and then some divinely inspired individual, who you and I call the Mashiach, will step forward and provide extraordinary leadership for Klal Yisrael and make us defeat all the Arabs and take over Eretz Yisrael, rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, do Kibbutz Kibbutz Golias, and so on and so forth. Right? Even promoting world peace. That's one way, that's a simple way of understanding it. However, when you look in those who gave more thought, shall we say, and more complexity to the future expected but still unknown messianic process, you see intermediary figures, such as the Mashiach ben Yosef. You go to the Gaonic description of messianic era as they see it, which the Rambam does not agree with, but I'm talking about Sadia Gaon, Bhai Gaon, great people. They say the whole thing will start with the Mashiach ben Yosef type. Hutaka will get killed along the way, similar to what happened with the Maccabee brothers. But their death will pave the way for the coming of the eventual Mashiach. So in other words, you don't go from 1 to 100 instantly. You go 1 to 50 and then 50 to 100. So what's 1? That's being completely in Gaulus under Geisha rule, having no rule of your own, no self-government. What's 100? Mashiach time, world peace, nirvana. Right? What's 50? Somebody who precedes the Mashiach, you see? Call him whatever you want. And that person, not like the Rambam, that person will lead Klal Yisrael in the right direction. He'll make everybody from or something like that. He'll retake all of Eretz Yisrael. There'll be no more Hamas. None of that junk. None of the Hezbollah business. Somehow or other, he'll rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. There'll be Makkah, the Karbonos, all the rest of it. And then when everything is just right, he'll hand it over to somebody from David HaMelech, his descendant from David HaMelech, be a Mashiach type figure. And literally, we'll all live, how's it go? You all live happy, happily forever after. How do you say it? They'll all live happily forever, you know what I mean. So, the intermediate period is very interesting. It's not a Melech, it's a Nasi. I think, now again, I can only say I think, that the Haftorah today, this week, in Yecheskel, is referring to that kind of a figure. That fits better. There are arguments to say it's a Melech. I know the different opinions. I'm telling you what strikes me this year in Tavshin Pei Dalet. And he says, there's a whole bunch of ceremonies. Al HaNasi Yeh HaOlos HaMich HaNasi B'chagin HaKadosh HaShabosos, that the Nasi will be in charge of bringing all the Karbonos. It sounds to me something like a Maccabean type figure in which the Nasi actually was a priest. And therefore, he sounds like some kind of a Kohen Gadol type figure, right? And they talk about the dangers of accruing too much power and wealth to the Nasi. You know, at the very end, it says, Ki tena Nasi matana lishmi bonav nachlasei lebonav tiyeh. If he gives a gift to his sons, it has to be his son's inheritance. But if he gives a gift to a regular Jew who's not from the family, there's no guarantee on that. It only lasts until Yovel, then it's got to go back. But that way, the purpose is to guarantee the Nasi a guaranteed income, so don't steal anybody else's land. He should supply his progeny from his own land. He'll be rich enough. So that the Jewish people will not be scattered, evicted from the property. It sounds like something that happened in the Hasmonean period, the Maccabean period. But I guess it's possible at the time that he's talking about that. Right? Maybe some Bible person does that. But if it's going to the Bais Shlishi, as we usually understand it, in the usual form interpretation, not the only, but the usual form interpretation. So the projection is that the third Beis HaMikdash will be a long drawn out process, the Geula. And first will arise somebody who doesn't necessarily have to be from the Malchus Beis Dovid. In the end, the person in charge will be the Malchus Beis Dovid. Right? The final person will be a Moshiach, and he'll have all the attributes. Again, it's not clear. Divine, semi-divine, I shouldn't say divine, but, you know, miraculous powers, non-miraculous powers, all that machlok is among the Rishonim. And he'll be able to, you know, do good things. But in the middle comes this Nasi figure. And best as I can tell, at least this year, sitting here, it sounds to me, when he talks about the Nasi having special privilege doing Beis HaMikdash, it sounds like the future leader will be a Kohen. Don't worry, I'm not bucking for the job. He says it'll be a Kohen who will end up being perhaps some kind of Kohen Gadol type figure. There's some indications of that. And is not the end of the story. Notice, and will be powerful and rich, and therefore has to have certain limits on his power, as you say in the last sukkim that I just described in the Haftarah today, coming up this week. But in the end, if you're wondering why is he talking about a Nasi, why is he talking about a Melch? The Melch will be the Melch Mashiach. Melch Mashiach, maybe things will talk to be supernatural, not like the Rambam, the way they go in and describe it. And you see the Chiyas HaMesim, who knows what. All that stuff is a jumble and nobody knows what order it comes in. The book of Yecheskel itself is highly suggestive. The Chacham were afraid of its extreme suggestiveness, which is one of the reasons they wanted to ban it. But in the end, as we all know, they overcame these fears. By the way, they didn't suspect that Yecheskel was doing anything wrong. He was a Nomi. They suspect that you'll misread it. You know, see? Yeah, when you do censorship, it's not only what the person had in mind, so how would it be read? And if you've ever edited anything, especially for from newspapers, so, oh, leave that out. Person didn't mean anything wrong, but the way it came out was not good. You know? But in the end, they kept it in, as we know. They kept the book of Yecheskel. Of course, they edited it. We don't know how. And therefore, they don't go to trouble to tell you what exactly is the meaning of the Nasi, which emerges as a very interesting and mysterious figure. But I think, there's long lines I just described. Anyway, that's my take this year in the Haftorah. Again, I want to thank Ari and Heather Elbaum and Ed and Robin Hoffman for dedicating today in memory of the mom of Mrs. Rose Insel, the mom of Dr. Jerry Insel and his wife. And I wish everybody a good week.
For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidovidkatz.com.